Today we're going to be looking at Genesis 9 and one of the most...
Are we past all these hard names?
No. Well, I mean, we're going to get into the really hard names we're going to get to next time.
Yeah, I was reading them as practicing.
Yeah. The nice thing is that we don't have to be persnickety and get it right because they're quite dead. And so we mispronounce their names, they're not going to matter, or they're not going to care. So, I suppose let's just go ahead and read this and do our usual thing. We'll read the whole thing, let it soak in, think about what stands out, and then we'll jump right into what I think is the real hook. There's a couple of real good nuggets here. But
I'm sorry, Dan, what was it?
Chapter 9.
9, okay, I got it.
So, or I can read, I don't think I've ever read yet, but it doesn't matter.
I'm always willing, but I also want to give others a chance if they would like to. And
I can try my best, I don't know.
There you go. Go ahead. Fantastic.
This is, then God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. The fear and dread of your will fall upon all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air, upon every creature that moves along the ground and upon all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hands. Everything that lives and moves will be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, I now give you everything. But you must not eat meat that has its lifeblood still in it. And for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting for every animal, and from each man too. I will demand an accounting for the life of his fellow man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made man. As for you, be fruitful and increase in number. Multiply on the earth and increase upon it. Then God said to Noah, and to his sons with him, I now establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that was with you, the birds, the livestock, and all the wild animals, all those that came out of the ark with you, every living creature on earth. I establish my covenant with you. Never again will all life be cut off by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the signs of the covenant I am making between me and you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all living creatures of every kind on the earth. So God said to Noah, this is the signs of the covenant I have established between me and all life on the earth. The sons, we go to the sons of Noah?
Yep.
Okay. Oh, you're going to excuse me, guys. Some of the pronunciation is a little rough for me. Then the sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. These were the three sons of Noah. And from them came the people who were scattered over the earth. Noah, a man of the soil, proceeded to plant a vineyard. When he drank some of his wine, he became drunk and lay uncovered inside his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it across their shoulders. Then they walked in backwards and covered their father's nakedness. Their faces were turned the other way so that they would not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and found out that his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves will be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. May Canaan be the slave of Shem. May God extend the territory of Japheth. May Japheth live in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his slave." After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. Altogether, Noah lived 950 years, and then he died.
Okay, so a lot of stuff going on here, and quite a bit in some section. So what stands out for you? Yep.
Just a quick question. Verse 26, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant," is what my translation says. Does that mean, may Canaan be the God, the Lord's servant, or may Canaan be Shem's servant? Like, do you know the actual?
Yes, we will come to that. But I'm saving that part till.
Sure. Yeah, to torture me, right? Got it.
Yeah, that's gonna get its own section there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Clearly, it's not explicitly stated, but the implicit vibe of this scenario with Noah and his drunkenness implies God's disgust upon dishonoring his father and approval on honoring his father by covering over his shame and nakedness and not humiliating him.
Okay. all right. So, we've got, I guess, to break this up, we have two sort of pieces in this chapter. There's the covenant slash rainbow piece, which it occupies the first half of this, you know, where God is saying, okay, going forth, this is the way that sort of the new world order is going to be. I'm making an agreement between myself and everything, that I'm never going to destroy it. What translation are you reading? But good reading, by the way.
This is
NIV.
NIV.
The one.
Yeah, the New International Version.
Interesting.
NIV.
Interesting. That particular section. Some translations do better with the text in different places. Some are, you know, pretty reasonably good. Some are terrible all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
But that one. Normally, I'm not a huge fan of the NIV, but like that's actually not doing too bad with the Hebrew there.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got this rainbow covenant together. So there's God says, this is the way in which I will relate myself to all of the created order. And then God gives some explicit directives to the human side for how they will relate not only to each other, but to the created order. Okay, so we've got the giving of animals for food, so everything is opened up. However, there's to be an accounting when it comes to the shedding of blood, and this sets up the stage for what will come in the giving of the Mosaic Law. There is this establishment of a capital punishment for those who commit murder. So that's interesting.
Including animals. I find that interesting as well.
Yeah. Like everything is to be, everything has to give an accounting. This is something too, we have an idea, and I have a sense of when it, you know, came into play, but the biblical texts assign moral responsibility two animals, right? The text, the Bible does not treat animals like, oh, they're just automatons that just kind of run around and whatever. Like, they are beings, they're nefesh. And so they have moral responsibility, and they have moral accountability, and we have a moral accountability with respect to them as well. So they're not humans, they're not in the image of God, but they are nevertheless, they possess the divine breath, just like we do. So there's a whole history of ideology, and it largely came as a result of the it's somewhat out of the Renaissance, but really a lot of the scientific revolution that sort of said, well, humans are the absolute apex and everything else is just scenery, including animals. They're just scenery. They're just there for doing whatever it is that we want, as if we already didn't see this with the ark, where God's making it clear, this isn't your stuff. Like, this is my creation. These don't belong to you. They're not just yours to do with whatever you want. But the fact that then later, and we see this in more explicit detail, where there are actual moral strictures given to animals that behave badly, like, there's actually law for that. So animals are morally responsible agents as well. In their own way, it's obviously not the same degree. So we've got that. Well, then we have this story of, you know, the vineyard, and then there's the first curse, right, that comes after this. So now we got to figure out what in the world is going on here. Yep.
As an aside to that, it always strikes me that there's no mention of Noah's wife anymore. And my personal feeling, not, you know, scripturally based, is that at this point she has passed away. And that's one of the reasons why he's trying to figure out what to do with his life. Like, he is lonely and bored. His kids have their own wives and children, and he is alone, basically.
Maybe. That's possible, although, as we'll see, there is some scholarly suggestion that that's, in fact, not the case.
Really? Well, then why wouldn't she cover his nakedness?
Well,
she should be at home.
Well, we're going to come to that.
All right.
So what do you guys think is going on in this curse? Now, this thing, you read it, and you're like, oh, okay. And then the more you read it, you're like, what? What is going on with this? It's really strange.
It is.
So let's, I always advocate trying to, that's why. Like, why is it so, there.
Yay.
It's better. Like,
let there be light.
I can't stand. I was like, why is it so dark? Let's try to block this out as a stage piece. And I want to know what you think is, like, in your mind's eye, when you read this, what do you see? Because there is a lot, and I mean a lot, of scholarly disagreement about what exactly is happening here and who is doing what relative to whom and when and where. And it seems this is like that thing that when we talked about, I guess, a couple of weeks ago, the whole I chased a monster with a great big bat, right? Like, you see something in your mind's eye, but what you're seeing is probably not what other people are seeing in their mind's eye. Because when they read this, they're like, oh, okay, that's what it seems like to me. But that's not what it seems like to everybody. And there's good scholarly reason to think a lot of things, actually.
Was Canaan mocking his father? Lack of respect right there, like making fun of his father because he was naked, and his two brothers show more respect than Canaan?
Canaan's not in the story.
No, he's the grandson here.
He's the grandson. He doesn't have anything to do with this.
Or
does he?
One of the sons.
Yeah, Ham.
Yes.
Ham is the one.
I mean Ham, yes.
But it's, so Ham is the one who does whatever is done that makes Noah curse, you know, issue a curse.
Ham.
But it's not Ham that's cursed. It's Canaan that's cursed, which is odd.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to ask.
His descendants.
Yeah.
Why is it cursed to be Canaan? I don't even know whether he was there at the time.
Could it be because God had already blessed all three of the sons, and therefore Noah can't pronounce any kind of a curse on the son, but the grandson?
His descendants.
Okay. Has God blessed Noah's sons?
When they got off the ark, he basically... So God blessed Noah and his sons, chapter 9, verse 1, and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth.
Okay, so... So... God blesses these folk. And of course their wives.
And Ham is the father of Canaan. Maybe that's why, you know, his descendants was cursed.
Yeah, but he's very personal about it. He says, the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers. I mean, this really gets personal.
It's very personal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Noah begins, the Hebrew says, begins to become a farmer. Right, I think it's easy for us to read. Oh, they get off the boat, and it's like a video game. Noah clicks vineyard, and then a vineyard poofs up, and then like suddenly he's drinking or something like that. Like, that's not how it works. In the best of circumstances today, with all the tech, assuming you had everything ready to go, and you knew what you were doing, it would take you at least half a decade to start a vineyard, like at least half a decade. And if you don't, like back then, presumably it would take at least a dozen years or more, right? And that's once you begin. So it doesn't say when he began. So we can assume safely that after the landing of the ark, probably there's like all this other stuff that, hello, basic necessities of life, build, you know, food, shelter, you know, basic infrastructure so that you can then have the leisure time. Like, doing a vineyard is not your primary business. That's like a leisure time. If you have already a steady income, you've got wealth, you have your basic needs, food, that kind of stuff sorted out, then you do the vineyard. So vineyard time is not till down the road a ways. So there is time passed, and we don't know how much time has passed, and it may well be, like in one scenario, indeed, it could well be that Noah's wife has died, and this is like, okay, I'm like retired or whatever, and like, this is what I'm doing. And, you know, perhaps, you know, drinking his troubles away. I've heard people say things like, oh, well, Noah's like the inventor of the vineyard. Well, there's no reason to believe that at all. Mm-hmm. It just, presumably, this stuff existed before, and like, Noah knew what he was doing, and he was like, my buddy, who's dead, like he had one, and I don't know.
Yeah, but to get wine out of the vineyard, it's a process.
Of course, yeah, and that too.
It takes time.
So there's time.
It takes a long time.
It takes time.
The vineyard doesn't hand you wine.
No.
There's a whole thing going on here.
Yeah, and so there's a process. So this, we assume, time has gone by. God has given a directive to repopulate the earth. And we know from the next chapter that all of his kids have lots of kids. So there's lots of kids being born. And presumably, lots of kids are being born in between the time when the ship lands and when this vineyard occurs. So that's something to bear in mind. But let's try to piece together exactly what is happening in the story. So Ham sees the nakedness of his father, whatever that means, that actually has some significance. He then tells his brothers about it. They go in backwards with, you know, a garment to, you know, they're walking backwards and their eyes are sort of downcast. Actually, like Luther's translation, the way that he translates it means that their eyes were looking anywhere except at their father. And they cover him over. So then Noah wakes up and realizes what has been done to him by his youngest son. So I want to ask you, who is his youngest son? Now I will tell you that there's some scholarship that suggests that Canaan was actually another son of Noah. that Noah had another kid after the flood, and that it was Canaan. But then some people say that doesn't make sense because no, you're adding a complication. There's several theories going on here. One theory is that Ham actually does something sexually to Noah. Right? That's one theory. And so Noah wakes up, realizes that this is done, and issues a curse. There's another theory that says while Noah is drunk, Ham engages in sexual activity with Noah's wife, his mother.
And where are they getting all this?
Canaan is the offspring of this, where Noah thinks that it's his kid, and then somehow realizes that. I think this is really stretching for the fences. There's not a lot of good evidence to support this. There's a theory that says Ham sort of mocks Noah. In other words, ridicules the drunkenness of his father and brings shame to it. And then there is, well, I'll leave it with these theories for the time being. But then I take that back. There's another one that suggests that it is Canaan, sort of the grandson of Noah,
yes,
who is the one who does the mocking. And so that is why, but it's because it's Canaan. Canaan is the son of Ham. Ham is the one who sort of who's held responsible for it, ironically, even though Canaan gets cursed for it. So you've got multiple theories which require us to do some very, very close reading of the text. Because when you read the order of the sons as listed, who's the youngest according to this listing?
Japheth.
It's Japheth. So let's remember that. Okay, so it as you read it, Shem, Ham, Japheth, and usually the sons would be listed in birth order, right? Like this guy, this, this, this. Okay, so we would say this is the eldest, Ham is the second, and then Japheth is the third. But then the text says that Ham is the youngest son. So that's weird. Now, this is the part of the show where the argument is made, you see, this confusion is the reason why we believe that there is some textual modification, or this is the fusion of multiple texts. This is the work of an editor that's just sort of splicing different things together, which is why it doesn't seem to make sense. So I want to hold that thought for the time being as we look at this, because this is weird. Like the ordering is strange. By this order, Japheth should be the youngest, so bear that in mind. But it says Ham is the youngest, Shem is the oldest. And so then we have all these theories. The text is so quiet about what occurs in the tent, but it does give us some clues. It says that Ham saw the nakedness of his father. Now, in biblical texts elsewhere, to uncover the nakedness of someone means to have sexual relations with them. You see this in the Levitical code multiple times, probably a dozen times, right? If you uncover the so-and-so's nakedness, right? If you uncover the nakedness of this person, you've uncovered the nakedness of your father. Usually it's like, you know, mother, father, etc. But it's a euphemism for sexual relations. So people have read this to say, okay, so Ham engaged in an obscenity with his father, but the problem is that the actual term uncover the nakedness is not what's used here. It says he simply saw the nakedness, which is different. Now, there is one instance, and then there's only one instance, where the seeing of nakedness is understood to have a sexual connotation, but it's used in the context of uncovering, and the uncovering is the one that's actually used, right? So it's almost like the seeing of the nakedness is then leads into the uncovering of the nakedness, even though the two are backwards, the one is a euphemism for the other. And that's why there's some idea that there's a sexual connotation here. But then the complication of Noah's wife, you know, and that somehow Canaan is the result of this makes literally no sense, because it would mean that Canaan would already have to be born, and somehow what? The idea that the euphemism, Ham saw the nakedness of his father, so that constitutes a sexual act, then why would the two other brothers use a garment to protect themselves from what Ham did? It doesn't make sense. It's like, well, let's have this garment up over and look anywhere so that we don't accidentally do something with our father. Like, it literally is absurd. It makes absolutely no sense. So I think that we can easily, this makes zero sense in any, like, you have to strain the text and the limits of human credulity so far to make that case. There was a scholarly paper that came out a few years ago, and that, you know, got traction because it was typical, right? Scholars have to be edgy and, you know, clickbait and all this stuff. But it's ridiculous, frankly. It doesn't make any sense. You could make a case for this. This one is, this is kind of, this doesn't make sense because, again, the response of his brothers, in other words, if Ham had actually done something like this sexually with his father, he would not have then gone out to tell his brothers about it. That doesn't make any sense at all. But there could be something where, if Noah is in a state of drunken stupor and has basically made a fool of himself, if a son is inclined to mock at that, that would make a lot more sense. Moreover, you know, but people say, well, then why does Noah not curse just the person who did it? Like, why doesn't he just curse Ham? Why does he curse Canaan? That doesn't make a ton of sense. Yeah.
Well, the biggest thing to me is, if Noah is passed out drunk and all of this is done in secret, mm-hmm. how does he awake and know that his younger son had done it to him? In my mind, I'm seeing little Canaan standing there going, guess what, Noah, blah, 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 and told him, because he has no idea who is doing what. He just somehow wakes up and says, oh, yeah, this was actually done by this, and then my sons did that. Like, he's passed out drunk.
Exactly, right? So by the same logic, and this is one of the things where it's funny, right? Just because somebody is a biblical scholar doesn't mean that they're a good reader. This is... I was just listening to Curran, who's a very big, sort of big name in biblical scholarship. I was listening to him talk about this, and I was like, dude, you're missing so much. Like, you can read this, like, you understand, you read this, that clears up this, because he's saying, oh, this is not normally the way that it is, so there's no reason to think that. I'm like, except right here it says explicitly that's how you're supposed to think about it. And you didn't even see that. Like, what are you talking about, dude? Like, I mean, it happens to everyone, you know. Nobody's perfect, but think about it. Again, I do maintain that if you map this out and treat it like a stage play, so much more of the text will make sense, because names, characters are not just dropping in out of thin air and then vanishing. Where is this taking place?
Around Noah's tent.
Okay, Noah's tent. What are the brothers of the sons of Noah just doing hanging around the tent? But just think about it.
What's family?
It's family. There's a community that's living around here. A community. Lots of people. By this time, lots of people. There's grandkids. There's like in some cases, probably great-grandkids. There's a lot of people running around here. If I come out, if I see a grandpa's drunk and naked, do you think it's just my two brothers who are going to hear this? Probably word is spreading.
The whole town.
And the whole, yeah, like the whole town is now knowing about this. So Noah becomes a source of ridicule. The two brothers and possibly other people are like, oh, let's see. Like, you know, let's see. And so the two brothers are like, no, we're going to cover you up. And, you know, maybe sort of stand guard, whatever. So why then the discrepancy, though? It goes Shem, Ham, Japheth. Seemingly, this seems to be the youngest. But Ham is said to be the youngest. Well, actually, just said he knew what his youngest son did to him. There's no name. And then he curses Canaan. How to explain that? Because that's where scholars say, well, it's obviously the work of an editor, because that doesn't make sense.
There's something here that it boggles my mind is, apparently Ham had four kids. He had Cush, Mizraim, Booth, and Canaan.
Yep.
Why he only curses Canaan and not the others?
Good question.
Now, one thing we have to keep in mind too is sometimes parents' decisions or mistakes, they come down, the result of their mistakes come down to their kids sometimes,
sure.
Many times.
Sure.
Yep.
If I have a father, instead of doing good businesses and investments so I can leave something for my kids when I die, and instead of that, I'm going to the bar and drinking and blowing my money away. By the time I die, my son don't have anything, that to inherit from me. So if we have the way I look at this is the decisions or the mistake that Ham did by making fun of his father or whatever he did, it probably came down to his kids. And I don't think it's just Canaan that was cursed, right? Because Cush, Mizraim, isn't that Egypt?
There's some speculation about
it.
It looks
like a curse upon the nation of Egypt in the time.
Yeah.
I just wondered why Ham just didn't cover him up.
You think about the personality. There's certain personalities that just like making fun of things.
There's always a troublemaker in the hall.
That's what I think. Guess what? That's drunk.
Think about rubbernecking that occurs in traffic. Like, there's some literally a train wreck, some horror on the road, and instead of showing dignity and not looking, everybody's like, "Ooh!" I watched someone film this horrific wreck, and they slowed down to film, and I'm thinking, why would you want to fill your head with that? But then it's obviously for the purpose of sharing. Hey, let me show you this that I saw. We think about people who used to go to public executions and things. Like, why would you want to fill your head with that and then presumably share it with others? So that suggests that there's obviously, there are some people who like that. They just enjoy. I know I have family members who just enjoy telling you grisly stories. And the more horrific, the better. And I have to tell them, stop. I do not want to hear it. Do not, like, you're showing an indignity to that person by telling me what happened to them. You are uncovering again what was done to them. Like, all right, it's not until this very moment that it even occurred to me, huh? Right, the uncovering of the thing. Like, don't do that. Yeah, and then Rich.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, in societies where there wasn't much to keep people occupied, like television and social media and stuff, like, gossip was rampant. Being in everyone else's business was rampant because we have this natural thing, part of our sin nature, part of our curiosity, to want to have sensational things and excitement and stuff to talk about. Like, she's a witch. Oh my gosh, let's get the whole town in uproar. You know, like, so that's one of the blessings of our modern times and being able to stare at a TV and not disturb other people. But yeah, I think that's one of the factors that comes into play in the personality of wanting to do this kind of stuff.
Cool, yeah.
Well, this has nothing to do with what you just said, but I was just wondering, what's the scholarship with the shamefulness of nakedness? Was it nakedness was only for marriage between two people, because there's a history of men having many wives or relations with many women.
Yeah.
I mean, the woman was clearly the underdog in all of this history.
Yeah, I mean, there's a sense in which, with the kind of modesty, I mean, think, with the initiation of the fall in the garden, nakedness becomes the emblem of human fallenness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so just the whole point is that they are trying to cover their nakedness. The notion of people seeing one another's nakedness, yeah, I think that there was a much greater push for modesty in the ancient world, for sure. So that to see someone's nakedness, and this is also used, I think we get a clue of this, it's used in a political sense too, right? Joseph said this to his brothers when he is still in disguise to them. He said, "You've come to spy out the nakedness of the land," like the vulnerability of the land. Like that term is used, nakedness is used as a term of ultimate vulnerability. So in a sense, there's the dishonoring of, you know, think about when you're at your most vulnerable, someone outing that or just exposing it, right? I think our modern culture is so out, like we want to just expose, like we want to be almost, we have this combination of exhibitionism and voyeurism to the point where we have actually become desensitized to true modesty and the significance. I mean, that was part of what the Nazis did to the Jews to fully humiliate them, was to like take up their clothes, right?
Right. Yeah.
And make everybody just sort of stand out there like cattle, naked. But it was deliberate to dehumanize them. I mean, Sartre talks about this. I mean, they would just do it to the Jews. They would do it to any of their sort of political enemies. They made sure that they stripped you naked so that you were completely not just vulnerable, but degraded and humiliated, right? So there's a sense of humiliation that's taking place here. So I think part of this is, and there are actually rule laws given in other cultures in the ancient world about punishments to sons who do not protect the dignity of their fathers when they're drunk, which is an interesting thing, right? So it's understood people will get drunk, but as a son, your primary obligation is to protect the dignity of your father, especially if he ever gets drunk. You protect him from himself.
Wasn't that why they covered him up?
Yes,
that's exactly that.
Exactly that, right? But again, if you don't have that additional context, it's like, oh, okay, that makes more sense, right? Even today, it's that way in many cultures that you show respect for your father, and if someone is drunk, you protect their dignity. So Ham, either way, doesn't do this, right? I think it has something to do with the fact that he goes out and tells them. And he doesn't tell them in a way that is, hey, guys, let's get him covered up. He tells them in such a way that they are the ones who take action to cover him up. He's not a participant in that. So that tells us that there's a mocking tone to it, and he actually wants them to see, and they don't want to see, right? That's the thing that is done as an antidote to what he has done, is the looking with disrespect. So the other argument, too, would be that it's possible that Noah's wife is there too, also uncovered, right? We don't know that. Like, that very well could be. So the question is then, why is Canaan cursed, and what's the deal with the ordering? Well, we find a clue in the next chapter. So now these are the records of the generations of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the sons of Noah. So it goes, but it starts with Japheth then. So like, oh, it's starting with the youngest son. That's interesting. But then later, let me find it. We see a clue, and we are cheating a little bit, but that's okay.
Well, if we think that the first verse gives the order of the sons, what follows is the opposite.
Okay.
I don't know why. He starts explaining things with the youngest son and then goes on up the order.
Yes, but if you look, and this is like one of these textual ambiguities here.
We just went through 9, now we're at 10.
In 10:21, we have an indication that Japheth is actually the oldest, which would mean Shem is the middle son, and Ham is in fact the youngest. So the text is not giving them actually in their birth order. So, you know, this guy is saying, oh, well, hey, there's no reason to believe that these guys are out of order. Well, yeah, actually there is, because the text tells you Ham is the youngest, and then later it says Japheth is the older brother of Shem. Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, then the true order is 1,
if it's
2,
the first one, yes.
3. And think about the irony, right? The whole point is, this is just my speculation on this. By this time, all these kids would have had to have been born. Cain has to exist for Noah to curse him. It doesn't make sense. And people again say, well, that's just a retro, you know, retcon on this. I'm like, it doesn't make sense. Think of the idea of measure for measure, eye for eye. The youngest son has disrespected his father. You are my youngest son. My youngest son disrespected me. I will disrespect your youngest son. I will curse your youngest son.
Mm-hmm.
That to me makes is much more like, right? If the youngest son dishonors his father, well, then I will dishonor your youngest son, and I will make him dishonored among all of his brothers.
Well, he had to already be there because he names him.
Of course, yes. So that is purely the interpretation of Dan that I think it makes sense in a human context, and it definitely makes sense with respect to the idea of balance. And, you know, much of the ancient world, this notion of balance. You did this to me, so I will do in equal measure to you what was done, and usually with a poetic twist. And notice, Melody, you are on to something. God has already issued a blessing for these sons. So that's one layer. In a sense, Noah would be countering the blessing of God. But let's pretend that we don't do that. If Noah curses Ham, there's a sense of injustice because these kids are also his children. If he curses him, all of these kids are included in the curse too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's possible they had nothing to do, who knows, like Canaan may have had something to do with whatever. But he's not targeting Ham totally. He's punishing his youngest, I think in an ironic way, or like a pointed way, precisely because the youngest dishonored his father, so I will dishonor your youngest. Yep.
Also, spoiler alert, I was wondering about the order that they keep being listed in here. Jesus did come from the line of Shem, so I'm wondering if that's why his is listed first.
Well, I mean, that's what we call like Semites, right? Shemites.
Yeah.
This clearly is, Shem is the father of the Jewish people. Who would become the Jewish people. Yeah.
So it's not according to verse 32. It says these are the clans of the sons of Noah according to their genealogies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not according to their birth order?
Nope. It's just a genealogy would just be according to who had what kid.
Well, right.
Because it lists them as Shem, Ham, Japheth, and then later the text explicitly says Ham is the youngest, not Japheth. Because if you read it in just the order, you would think Shem is the oldest, Ham is the second, and Japheth is the youngest. But then the text explicitly says that Ham is actually the youngest. And then later, it says Japheth is Shem is the younger brother of Japheth, who's the elder.
again. So it's like it just has them out of order, and we don't know why. But it keeps the fact that it keeps pointing it. It doesn't take long to deduce. Okay, well, we know what's the order. In fact, yeah.
Is there any scholarship that determines or speculates about which one of these people populated what part of the earth?
Oh yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's tons. Oh yeah, extensive.
Okay, I'll ask the obvious question: where did the Chinese come from?
That I can't tell you because that's like that. I could look it up, sure, get you an answer, but yeah, like
the Chinese are ham. Aren't they the Chinese?
I think
who?
Again,
Chinese are Kush are out of ham.
Yeah,
Kushites I thought were the Ethiopians.
Yeah, the Kush was that whole region that was like legendary for their gold.
Yeah, but that's all local to that area. I'm talking about the whole world.
Yeah, I'm not actually sure. I actually don't know, but I could look it up.
Yeah.
It's like you cannot know. Nobody can know. Nobody can begin to know everything about everything.
But I'm sure there's a person who thinks that they do.
Yeah, but I mean, there are people who have done tons of scholarship on it.
I'm sure that there is.
Because Kim Han has a whole map of it.
Yeah.
And there's different scriptures that point to the Asian, because Turkey was the beginning of Asia,
mm-hmm.
Asia Minor, and then it moved out Mongolia,
yeah, India, of course, yeah.
India, and all of that came out of the Kushite people, moving. He has a whole map where everybody in the Middle East can be traced to their lineage, mm-hmm. and then as people moved out, they began to isolate according to their phenotype, their genes, this person married this, whatever they valued. So, and then that's why the Japanese are the most, I guess, purest of Asians.
But they're pretty isolated.
And then you go north, and the Norwegians are the most, quote-unquote, Japeth or of the Europeans. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
But how many thousands of years had to transpire to get Oriental Asians out of this?
Not even thousands, hundred. Like,
yeah,
it only takes
a
generation. It's just genes.
No, but the whole thing, the whole, you know, the Japanese, the Oriental person, it's completely different.
When you think about the genetic, remember, we're always losing genetic information.
Mm-hmm.
Genetic information is lost at a much more rapid rate, right, than anything could be introduced. And so you think about the variety, I forget what the exact number is, but two people can produce literally billions of different combinations,
yes.
Wildly different combinations, like things that you wouldn't even, and you wouldn't fathom. And so you think, if you're this far back in the genetic pool, it would stand to reason that, I mean, think about it, the whole planet came from Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of genetic material in there and information. We got a boogie. But I could definitely. But in some cases in the biblical text, it tells you where they moved and like what region they populated. So you actually have some sense of like, okay, I know this person came from this person came from this person, and they populated that region. And now you actually are kicking into archaeology, so you know we know who these people were. And if you line that up, you can figure out who came from where. So, but in terms of China, I can't tell you right off the bat. I definitely could look it up for you, for sure. Yeah. All right. Good stuff, gang. Let's get out of here. I'll praise that, I guess. Dear Lord, thank you for my brothers and sisters. Thank you as well, as always, for your word and the delight that we have in digging in it. Be with us now and in the coming days and weeks. Let us be salt and light to the world and do all things to your glory. In the name of your Son, Christ, we pray. Amen.
Amen.